The February cyber attack on Change Healthcare continues to cause prescription delays, and that is stressful on patients and doctors, but not if the doctors are using iCoreRx cloud e-prescribing software. iCoreRx had zero interruption, and iCoreRx is a product of iCoreConnect, whose full platform of secure products helps streamline workflow and increase revenue. Check them out at iCoreConnect.com/MGMA.
Hello and welcome to the MGMA Consultants Corner podcast. I'm Daniel Williams, senior editor at MGMA and host of the MGMA Podcast Network. We're joined today by James Corbett and Kate Bailey. We're going to be talking to them about their healthcare journeys, behavioral health, some trends in behavioral health, and their work as MGMA consultants. So, first of all, congratulations for joining the MGMA team.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're happy to be here. It's important work, and your stakeholders are very driven, and we're happy to work with them.
So, secondly, I'd love to hear a little bit about each of your healthcare journeys. So let's just start with you, James. What do you want to share with us today?
Okay. Well, if you remember anything from this, remember I'm a bit of a peculiar duck. I have both a law degree and a Master of Divinity, and that has driven my role in healthcare throughout my career. I spent a lot of time on the inside of hospitals, 15 years in four different states, working at the executive level in the C-suite. And my background in both law and theology allowed me to navigate things such as the ethics committees, managing behavioral health throughout the system, managing the chaplains. So I've got a diverse background with a lot of experience in a lot of states. And then Kate and I had the pleasure of working together in Massachusetts, where together we had oversight of the most number of psych and substance use beds in the state of Massachusetts. So a lot of operational experience inside health systems, and sadly, some of the scars to prove it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. And that is a unique background, James. So thank you for that. Kate, same thing with you.
Yeah. Thank you, Daniel. It's really a pleasure to be here and to be on with you today. So I started my career in healthcare. And in addition to working with James in behavioral health on the hospital side, I worked with a healthcare network where I focused on supporting practices really in process improvement, quality improvement, HEDIS measures, and performance related to payer contracts. Also worked with the Medicare ACO. And when I branched into consulting, I started working in other areas like Medicaid strategy and behavioral health, which really required hospitals and practices to start to think about the other partners in their community and other clinics. So I was able to design and lead those types of partnerships, which are really attractive to grant funders. So I was also able to help drive some practice change that was supported by additional funding streams. So today I consult across the country with health systems, with local governments, from behavioral health to public health strategy, and kind of a wide variety of applications, and really feel privileged to be able to do so.
Yeah, after hearing your story as well, Kate, you both have unique backgrounds to get to behavioral health. So that's really cool. I want to stay with you, Kate, for this next question. So the three of us met a couple of weeks ago, and we discussed the integration of behavioral health into medical practices, into primary care practices. So talk about some of the challenges there that you're seeing.
Sure. So I think some of the challenges are for practices is just really in how, for those that are coming into it new, how did they get started? You know, where to start? And one of those questions that the practice will ask is, what model is going to be right for me? So, you know, this is a different relationship, behavioral health integration, than like the typical PCP specialist relationship, even if you had a co-located specialist in your office suite. You have to think about things like, you know, what types of behavioral health specialists are going to be best suited to your practice? How are you going to communicate and collaborate? How are you going to credential and bill? And so all of this needs to be set up well at the outset, and it takes some dedicated time and effort, which I know that is really hard to come by at this time.
Yeah. Now, I want to give a little context and background about behavioral health right now and what practices are seeing. I think our listeners are well-versed in this. They know that there's been a huge spike in behavioral health, in the need for mental health, for therapy, for all the things out there that practices and therapists can provide. James, share a little bit about that. What are we seeing there that have emerged in that post-pandemic environment?
Yeah, great question. I think as a start, I want to take a step back and kind of, you know, talk about what's really a term of convenience, behavioral health. What does behavioral health even mean? And the fact that we have to have this conversation highlights that unlike oncology or orthopedics or other specialties that are well-defined, behavioral health is still in a state of transformation. So behavioral health is a term of convenience that covers both mental health and substance use disorder, but substance use disorder is a form of a mental health issue. So it's really classified under the broader term of mental health. So what are we seeing? We're seeing one, sadly, due to years of underinvestment in behavioral health, both at the federal level, the state level, and at the organizational level, large health systems, that we are in a state of what's been called behavioral health crisis nationwide. At the same time, we know that we have low in reimbursement as it starts to come to bear. And then sadly, we have a lack of standardization that we would not accept in any other specialty that's become a norm in behavioral health. On the positive, with that stark background, we do have funding that's coming in larger numbers than it's ever come before in behavioral health. Now, a lot of this is driven by the federal opioid settlement, which is the second largest federal settlement only behind tobacco settlement. And what we're starting to see now, I've been in the privileged position of working with counties and states to actually disseminate the money and how they will spend the money. We're seeing as money is trickling out across the country, that number will end up in with a B in terms of what how much is coming out across the country in the B. And I think that there's tremendous opportunity for practices and physicians to play a role. The healthcare ecosystem as it relates to behavioral health is tremendously broken. So states and counties are looking to leverage federal dollars to bring in practices who can play a role in the outpatient side and to partner more closely in what's called crisis care. I think I'll pause there and we'll talk more about crisis care later in the conversation.
Yeah, so I wanted to follow up with that. How does that, when those federal dollars are being dispersed, how are they reaching the practice and how is the practice then utilizing them?
Yeah, well, I'll say that we're in the infancy stages here, right? So okay. The settlement dollars started to trickle out last year, and many communities are getting their spend, their fair share, if you will, based on how they were impacted by the opioid crisis over a 15-year period. So for 15 years, these communities will have dollars they previously didn't have. And their first start is to come up with RFPs and request community members, practices, and others apply to receive these funds. Sadly, it's not communicated probably in ways that everyone knows this is happening right now. So one is an opportunity to build awareness about what fundings are coming out when and what timeline. Two, they usually have guardrails. They'll say, here are five things that you can use and spend this money on, and please apply to be a part of it. I would argue at a macro level, physician practices and health systems need to be at the table, understanding what's happening and understanding how those monies are being disseminated. From somebody who's seeing it from the inside right now, it's really at the governmental level. The state has it, they pass it to the county passes it to the city, and then they decide how to spend it. And I feel like we need to bring both the healthcare infrastructure and those who have been working in behavioral health and public health for years together so that we can all make sure the spend is the most evidence-based and efficacious for our patients.
Okay. Beyond that, what are some other trends you're seeing emerging then in this, you know, kind of coming out of the pandemic? We had talked about this earlier when we met. So what are you seeing out there?
Yeah, I think the biggest move, thank you for that, is the crisis care movement. So I think that historically, hospitals and others have focused on acute care, and there's a great need for acute care. And then we focus on outpatient care, and again, a great need for outpatient care. But there's a tremendous understanding now, particularly in post-COVID America, particularly as behavioral health issues were exacerbated, that we need crisis care. And the crisis care guidelines were just pushed out by SAMHSA a couple of years ago. So they're starting to be embraced by communities around the country. I would argue that unfortunately, health systems and physician practices aren't as aware of these SAMHSA guidelines. But these guidelines focus on someone to call
someone to respond, and someplace to get help. All three of those spectrums are now part and parcel of crisis care with national standards on how to address them. So for someone to call 988 instead of 911 if you have a mental health issue, practices should know to tell their patients to call 988. You can text or chat. Someone to respond instead of the EMT responding for every 911 call. When you call 988, at times it's a social worker or someone with lived experience who can respond. And in that third area is somewhere to go. That's where crisis care facilities are being built. So instead of waiting for someone to have capacity on an outpatient level or an inpatient level, crisis care facilities with receiving chairs and a healing milieu are starting to develop around the country. And that's a place for folks to get stabilized as opposed to waiting in an emergency room for an acute care bed. So I'm really excited about the crisis care movement because I think it's going to play a role in changing the behavioral health crisis. And it's something that practices should be aware of and garner access to and referral patterns to their patients right away.
Okay. One more thing with you, James. So we've seen the spike in the need for care. We've also seen staffing shortages in other areas of healthcare. Is there also a staffing shortage in behavioral health?
Absolutely. As odd as it sounds, whenever we're starting to help a community with their behavioral health issues, be it dealing with those experiencing homelessness or building a facility, or how do you even develop mobile crisis teams to support community-based care, we have to say in a parallel fashion, where is the community college? Where is the school? Because we're going to need to develop the workforce to work in these areas. It's particularly acute in rural communities, but it's also a problem in urban communities. The great news is that our academic partners, community colleges and universities, have been at the table in a lot of the communities we're working on. So from day one, they're working through their process to start a program to elevate social workers. We've actually been doing this at the high school level in some communities and rural communities. So it's great work. It's not easy work. But the way I look at it is while people like me and the government officials are working to build the infrastructure and to come up with new protocols and procedures, I feel like we really need to marry up with the physicians and physician practices so their needs are met. It's almost like there's a whole data set of learnings that aren't being utilized as we build the behavioral health crisis of the future.
Thank you for sharing that. So, Kate, I want to come back to you and something you were talking about both in your background and other things you dealt with. But that's the billing and staffing issues that we're facing. So what are some strategies that practices can engage in?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I think James alluded to some of the workforce development work that is being done across the country and that we're a part of in certain rural areas. I think it's important to recognize that things are changing. There's some bright spots on the horizon. You know, recently Medicare approved reimbursement for clinicians, licensed behavioral health clinicians in certain fields that they hadn't before. And so being aware of that and knowing that, you know, things are changing is important. I think we can all play a role in advocacy to payers to increase reimbursement rates, to be more adequately matching with the, you know, the cost of providing the service, and then really understanding what resources are available in terms of incentivization. So there are funds coming down from the federal government. There are loan repayment programs. There's ways that practices could even help their existing staff to advance. But even getting folks in the door, I would say work with your local colleges and universities, set up supervisory relationships where you can still have incident two billing, but be able to fill the gaps in your staffing and your workforce in the meantime.
Okay. Now, as far as the billing side of it, is coding a challenge here? Are there new codes that have been integrated? Anything else you want to share about the codes?
Yeah, so I think that the coding is a challenge because of the requirements that you have to fulfill to make sure that you can use, for example, the collaborative care model codes. Mm-hmm. While they're not new, it's still a new operation for a lot of practices. And so to be able to set those things up in advance, for example, a registry of patients that are going to be covered under collaborative care is one of the requirements to be able to use those codes. And if you're a practice that hasn't done much population health, then a registry of patients is very new to you. So it's uncharted territory in some sense, but when you are set up, then it does go along well.
Okay. James, I want to come back to the topic you were talking about earlier, and it's that role primary practices can play in helping address the national mental health crisis. Take a deeper dive there. What can they do? What can they start doing today or the rest of this year?
Okay. Well, as a start, I'd say that I want to be really clear that I'm aware of the challenges of that practice managers and administrators have, particularly in small practices, particularly in those that are not connected to hospitals. Those connected to hospitals have a separate set of challenges. But for those that are independent, the practice managers I talk to, it's hard for them to schedule lunch. So it's hard to think about putting anything extra on top of them. At the same time, the physician practices, the physicians and the nurse practitioners are all seeking to grow the business while providing patient care. So the amount of time they have is very limited. And with that as a starting point, I want to think of a couple of things that they can do right away that would be a good return on investment with their time, which is their most valuable asset. So first, as these monies are trickling down, like, so most states have the money for opioid settlement dollars at the state level, and then it'll come, they'll keep a portion there and they'll send it to counties and others. I think that every practice should have a pulse on what their state opioid dollar amount is coming in, what their community level is, that city or county they're in, and what the parameters are for getting access to those funding. Sometimes it's a harm reduction effort. Sometimes it's a campaign. Sometimes it's outpatient care. They need to understand the framework and understand how they can play a role in it. Earlier in the process, they could even shape what's being decided, but many states that ship has sailed, at least for the first round of funding. So one, play the outside aspect of practice management is at an all-time high, understanding that in the world of behavioral health. So understanding that at least on the opioid spend level would be an important aspect of it. And then two, I'll tell you, every state that Kate and I are working in, 12 different states right now, working on this at a granular level, they all are saying, they being the counties and the cities that we're working with, they need more support on the outpatient behavioral health. And I recognize that one of our biggest challenges, and we talk to physician practices, is that they saying, well, I want to do it and my patients need it, but I've got pretty thin margins. How far can we go without losing our shirt? How much can we do when we don't really understand the new models of coding and on and on? So I think a decision has to be made at the practice about what amount of time they can spend in this and what amount of financial resource they can spend in this. And then I think they need to partner with organizations such as MGMA so we can show them evidence-based models and we can show them from competitive audits how other communities similarly situated practices have tackled it. The key is you can't boil the ocean. I've been accused of that in my career with Master Divinity, wanting to boil the ocean. But I do think there's steps, pragmatic, tactical steps they can take to improve the care of their patients in behavioral health, generate revenue for their practices, and do a service to their communities.
Okay. Kate, I want to turn to you then. What are the first steps if a practice wants to begin integrating behavioral health into their practice? What do they do first?
Yeah, so I think, initially it's going to start and end with leadership buy-in, right? And it's really good, especially if you have multiple providers in the practice, to have one provider that is passionate about behavioral health integration and is really going to lead the way, because it's going to take a bit to develop that relationship between the medical health provider and the behavioral health provider. And if one relationship can be very solid, then the other relationships can flow from that. It's going to take a workflow redesign. It's going to take new hiring of staff and credentialing. And so I think just taking some dedicated carve out time for that leadership and that relationship to form, but then also to have dedicated time for planning and to set up the proper infrastructure is going to be just so beneficial in the long run, so that this is a real win-win. And, you know, the dividends aren't going to just be financial, but in the terms of the patients of the practice getting the assistance that they need without a 6-month waiting period, it's going to benefit them and it's going to benefit their providers that are dealing, they're be more well equipped to deal with the whole patient, the whole person, and we'll get away from this siloed nature of behavioral health versus physical health.
Yeah, thanks for that. Now, James, you brought up something earlier. You dropped the idea of the 988 mental health hotline. You asked me about that when we met a couple of weeks ago to discuss this podcast. I'd heard of it, but I didn't really know that much about it. So How can practices best promote resources like that and others?
Yeah, you know, as a start, physician practices and really the provider who's in front of the patient have a tremendous challenge. Do you ask about something when you know that you might not have the resources to address it? And if there's a mental health challenge with your patients you want that's impacting their physical health, you want to consider it. You want to be able to talk about it. But in the past, you haven't really had a readily available resource to connect them to. There's waiting lists. There's cash payments required at times from mental health providers. So about a little over a year ago, the feds developed what's called 988. It's the new version of 911. For mental health and behavioral health issues in particular. And much like when they built 911 back in the 50s, you started with a 911 number and then you built EMT, fire, police all around it. That's what's happening real time with a 988. So 988 is the entry into a crisis, a behavioral health crisis, and practices across the country need to know about it. There's a study that said that less than 20% of Americans right now know that 988 even exists. And it's such a tremendous resource because studies show that upwards of 80% of the people that call 988 never need to call 911, never need to make an ER visit. So think about it for a moment. And we do this in statewide campaigns in places like New Hampshire, where their state moniker is called Live Free or Die. How do you get a middle-aged white man to get help in a state like that when there's a certain rugged individualism? Well, you start making the concept of asking for help a strong thing to do. So in that state, we came with a campaign called Strong as Granite. Call 988 is a strong thing to do. And we're actually starting to see the impact of that. But what I suggest is that 988 is kind of, and we're doing this in New Hampshire, working with the hospital association, where you put these flyers in the patient room, where you can give out cards to the patient, 988. And 988 is really important to understand. It's not for those who have suicide ideation only. The way we advertise it is it's important to you, it's important to us. If you're a youth and you're feeling overwhelmed, text or chat 988 for that insight. And it's 24/7. And it's that type of insight you get early in the disease burden, mental health concerns and challenges, much like most health issues. When you address them earlier in the prognosis, you have a better chance. And with mental health, you have a better chance for coping mechanisms and others to be embraced if you catch it early in the disease burden, before it's a full-blown concern that might need an acute care admission. So 988 needs to be shouted from the mountaintops. Fortunately, there's something called a Sonic logo that the folks at iHeart have just developed. If you think of a Sonic logo, think of Netflix, like da-da, and you're like, oh, that's a Netflix movie. We'll have a new Sonic logo for 988 because that auditory learning is something that's very important for people to remember a number.
I love that. I love that so much. So we've been using the terms behavioral health and mental health back and forth. And so just to clarify that, James, let's define those two terms and see how much they're the same or how they're different.
Yeah. So mental health is the kind of, I have a book behind me that says exact code what mental health challenges are. It's a designation for funding. But a mental health concern is something that is tied to this kind of bringing back together whole person care. So there's physical concerns and there's mental health concerns. And I think what I was highlighting earlier is this substance use and a substance use disorder is a form of a mental health. So we could only talk about mental health and we would cover both mental health and substance use. The challenge is that people become confused when you do it that way. And the term of convenience, the overarching umbrella term for both mental health and substance use, is considered behavioral health. But I'll say again that, when you talk to some people about behavioral health, they're saying, what do you mean behavior? Behavior change? So you've got this loose term of convenience as an overarching term.
Okay. Now, we started this discussion by saying that we're in the early stages of integrating behavioral health into practices. So Kate, this is our final question here. I want to hear from you first and then James, but let's look into the future. What's going to be happening 5 and 10 years from now with that integration of behavioral health?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think we're going to just see more and more of a push toward holistic care at every point of entry in the healthcare system. And that's inclusive of the social drivers of health as well. In January, CMS announced its newest innovation in behavioral health model. and it's a demonstration project that's going to take 8 years, and 8 states will be selected later on this year to participate. But what's really interesting about this one is that it's actually the reverse of how we usually think about behavioral health integration, whereas behavioral health provider organizations are going to be the entry point, and then physical health primary care services will then be integrated into the behavioral health location. And when I think about that and consider some of the work we do in certain states where these behavioral health providers are actually in some places just completely siloed from the rest of the traditional healthcare system, I mean, this is monumental. Some of these behavioral health providers are still being paid or funded from the state based on basically a block grant. And to get to a fee-for-service type of model, there's going to need to be like a very thoughtful infrastructure build so that this actually works and we do it well. So I was happy to see that, you know, 8 years, that should be a good amount of time to be able to get that set up. But again, I just think across the board, we're going to see every entry point that folks are going to be start to be considering what are the complete needs of this individual, whether it's oncology, primary care, emergency medicine, and so forth.
All right. Well, James, how do you want to end this discussion? What do you see in the future as well?
Yeah, well, one, I'm very exuberant about this because I think the opportunities are immense. And I think that the way we're talking about behavioral health now and the way we'll be talking about it in 5 years is tremendously different. And I think it's driven from three different areas. So first, I'll go back to the evidence-based practices. We have a lot to learn in the field of behavioral health and a lot of shoring up to do because for so long it's been underfunded. We haven't had, frankly and sadly, some of the best and brightest focus on this space. A lot of them have been driven into things that are more money producing and more revenue producing. And if you're an administrator, do you want to manage behavioral health or do you want to manage big money oncology or these other things? And sadly, that time has been in place for a while, but it's changing. So we're going to have better minds at the table, better access and better evidence about what works and doesn't work, and a real focus on ensuring that we have evidence-based care. That's bucket one. Two, what I'm excited about is it's going to be patient-driven and hyper-local. When you think about the transformations that are happening, a lot of it driven by funding that's out there, there's a lot of community groups that are going to get funding that historically they haven't had in order to try and experiment new things. And that leads us to technology. The technological innovation that's happening in behavioral health is on fire. There's a behavioral health tech conference where all they talk about in a conference setting for 3 days is behavioral health technology. Think about how amazing that is. In the past, you couldn't do that, but now it's happening. I just left it in Arizona a couple of months ago. And what you're seeing there is things such as like wearables and monitors and things that can help determine if someone's heartbeat rate is going faster, yet they're telling you that maybe I am not having a challenge with substance use, you have a different data point. Now, I want to pause for a moment. As an ethicist, this is an important area where we all have to lean in a little bit and say, at the time of improving care using technology, can we also hardwire ethical principles that take into account privacy and take into account autonomy as we seek to leverage technology to ensure compliance with certain protocols. And last, I'm very excited about this built environment. Now that we are talking about building crisis care facilities and not acute care hospitals or behavioral health emergency departments, you have two things that can occur. One, a lower spend from $40 or $50 million for a behavioral health facility that's focused on acute care to somewhere in the range, depending on the geography, $10 to $12 million. For a crisis care facility. You also have the architects who can come in with a lot more exuberance and excitement around what's possible in building a non-hospital-based mental health facility that can focus on the healing milieu. I took a group from Palm Beach County, Florida, and brought them here to Colorado. I took them up to Northern Colorado, Larimer County, where they have a model for the nation. They used a mill levy tax to fund it, and they continue to fund it for 10 years after the spend, and then that community will decide if they want to spend again to continue it. But what's happening now is they're using the mountains, they're using the glass, they're using the light space to ensure that the health of these patients can be improved without exacerbating it in the staid environments of an emergency room or location with low light and low visual appeal. So the built environment is going to be super exciting, which we're going to see in that space. Technology can't be held back. So we'll see strength there. And then we'll see this hyper-local focus where people in the community get to drive and shape behavioral health care, mostly driven by the opioid settlement funding. So I think it's a tremendous time in behavioral health, an exciting field to be a part of.
That is exciting. And you had me leaning in, and I heard a little bit of that Master of Divinity coming out, James. I heard it. So you had me very excited there. That's wow. What a wonderful story. Great to meet both of you. And I'm so glad y'all are on the MGMA team. Thank you, James and Kate.
It's an honor. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's a privilege. Thank you.
Well, that is going to do it for this episode of Consultants Corner, the MGMA podcast. We've been joined by MGMA consultants James Corbett and Kate Bailey, and we've been discussing the integration of behavioral health in primary practices. We're going to provide some additional links to the episode show notes for y'all to click right through to. Until then, thanks for being an MGMA podcast listener. Are you tired of dealing with time-consuming processes and outdated strategies? It's time for a change. Introducing Laserfish, the leading platform for optimizing process automation and data analytics. With Laserfish, you can transform your organization into a technology-driven powerhouse, ready to tackle any disruption that comes your way. Laserfish allows you to strategically optimize workflow automation so you can revamp cost-inefficient initiatives across your organization. Free up your staff's time so they can focus on more meaningful work. So don't let outdated processes hold you back. Unlock the power of Laserfish and take control of your organization's future. Visit laserfish.com today and learn how it can help you achieve efficiency, resilience, and success. Again, go to laserfish.com.